Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Still looking for its first major legislative accomplishment, the Trump administration has proclaimed this to be Infrastructure Week. The rollout includes a plan to privatize the nation's air traffic control system. Modernizing the nation's airports, roadways, and bridges was a $1 trillion campaign promise that at one point many Democrats suggested they might support. But the devil is in the details, as they say, and these days, the politics are particularly devilish in Washington. This hour on Point, the president turns to infrastructure. You can join us on air or online. Can Washington finally come together on a plan for modernizing the nation's infrastructure? What do you think of President Trump's public-private partnership approach, which we're going to be talking about this hour? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining me first from Washington, D.C. is Lauren Gardner. She covers transportation for Politico Pro. And Lauren, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Anthony.
So tell us first about the broad approach of the Trump administration's plan for infrastructure. What are we hearing this week about that approach?
So President Trump on the campaign trail talked a lot about the nation's roads, bridges, airports, the crumbling state of American infrastructure. And he's looking to hit on all of those points to some degree this week. Started off with the air traffic control initiative, like you mentioned. That's an idea that's been batted around a lot since the 1980s, actually, here in Washington, and in the last couple of years has started to gain steam with some Republican members. That effort's been led by the House Transportation Chairman, Bill Schuster. And then the president's going to pivot to inland waterways on Wednesday, and he's going to be talking a little bit more about rural infrastructure and concerns in rural America about some of the public-private partnership ideas that he's been touting. And then later in the week, he's going to be talking more about streamlining the permitting process for approving road and bridge improvement projects.
All right. Well, I want to get into a lot of these details with you. Let's hear first from President Trump. He promised, as you mentioned, from the start of his campaign to lead a huge national infrastructure upgrade. Here he is delivering his State of the Union address to Congress on February 28th about this.
To launch our national rebuilding, I will be asking Congress to approve legislation that produces a $1 trillion investment in infrastructure of the United States, financed through both public and private capital, creating millions of new jobs.
So, Lauren, I want to ask you about this. And just to be clear, Trump is not talking about $1 trillion of government spending. He's talking about what he's calling a public-private partnership with the government. How does he want to do this? What's the vision for funding this?
So the administration has said that they envision getting $200 billion of federal funding and using that to leverage financing from the private sector, from state and local governments to help fill in the gaps to make improvements to national infrastructure. And there weren't any details in the budget, any firm details about how specifically they want to get how specifically they want to cover the $200 billion price tag. It was kind of just on the whole, they said the budget balanced. And there were no suggestions, for example, on how to make the Highway Trust Fund solvent, whether or not the country should move to a mileage fee for vehicles to help make up the gap in the gas tax. So there's still some questions there. And detractors from this plan have questioned, you know, how can they guarantee that up to $1 trillion would actually be produced under this? So there's still some details to be filled out, and we'll be looking for that this week.
Sure. And, you know, as someone who covers this beat, Lauren, I'd love it if you could just sort of lay out the national need for infrastructure improvement. I mean, how would you describe what the challenge is out there that the Trump administration is trying to address?
funding infrastructure improvements has been a huge issue in Congress the last several years. The Highway Trust Fund is funded by the gas tax that consumers pay at the pump and don't even really know about it because it's just built into the price. And the purchasing power for that has plummeted in the last several years as people drive a little bit less, cars get more miles to the gallon, so people aren't filling up as much at the pump. And Congress has had a big problem trying to figure out how to fill those gaps, and they've ended up going into the general fund of the Treasury to help fill in the gap instead of raising the gas tax or even indexing it to inflation. The last time the gas tax was addressed was in the early 90s in terms of raising it in any way. So paying for all of these things has been a big issue on Capitol Hill, and that's probably the most major issue to date is, you know, as the nation's infrastructure ages, as, you know, the interstate highway system is now 60 years old, how are we going to sustainably fund all of these things?
That's right. So Lauren Gardner, she covers transportation for Politico Pro. I want to talk to you about some of the specifics from yesterday about the Trump administration's proposal to privatize the air traffic control system. How would that work? What does the Trump administration want to do?
So the Trump administration is building off of the proposal that I talked about earlier that Chairman Schuster had had in the last Congress to essentially create a nonprofit governing board that would oversee air traffic control operations that would be separate from the government. So FAA would retain its safety authority, but in terms of actually having responsibility for handling air navigation responsibilities, that would be under the control of this separate corporation. And what they're envisioning is transferring the FAA air traffic controllers into this entity, but still keeping all their pay and pay and benefits, their union protections, and just having it be a separate system. And they say that by doing this, it frees up the air traffic control apparatus from having to deal with the stop and start uncertain nature of federal funding. There have been issues with appropriations on Capitol Hill, as everyone knows. The yearly funding deadline is always September 30th, and Congress always seems to go to stopgap solutions to try and buy themselves more time to develop a fuller fiscal year budget. And there have been a lot of complaints that this prevents the FAA from long-term planning needed to really modernize the systems that they have in place.
All right. Well, let's listen to President Trump again. Here he is yesterday at the White House explaining how the government and the private sector would divide up responsibility for managing the nation's skies and what it would cost the public. Here's the president.
This new entity will not need taxpayer money, which is very shocking when people hear that. They don't hear that too often. Under this new plan, the Federal Aviation Administration will focus firmly on what it does best, safety. A separate nonprofit entity would be charged with ensuring route efficiency, timely service, and a long-awaited reduction in delays.
Now, there has been pushback. Here's Senator Bill Nelson, Democrat of Florida, who says he's not buying the president's plan to hand the nation's air traffic control grid to private hands. He's the top Democrat on the Senate Commerce Committee, which oversees the Federal Aviation Administration. Here he was on the floor of the Senate yesterday.
Let's hand over to the airlines all the people and the equipment essential to the safe operation of our nation's air traffic control system and trust them, the airlines, to manage our skies.
So, Lauren Gardner, this brings me to the next question I wanted to ask you. We heard a pushback there from Senator Nelson in Florida. What kind of reception has there been to this plan to privatize air traffic control?
It's been very mixed. On Capitol Hill in the House, in terms of the Transportation Committee, last year the Republicans were mostly united, save for a couple of members who have a significant general aviation interests in their district. But when it comes to the wider Republican caucus, it's been tepidly received by tax writers, some senior appropriators, the lawmakers in charge of setting spending within the federal government. They've been opposed. And it really remains to be seen how many more of them will be influenced to perhaps reconsider their thinking now that the president has given such full-throated support for this. And Democrats have largely been in opposition to this. There may be a couple here and there who think it could be a good idea, but Democrats on the House Transportation Committee are largely opposed. In the Senate, it's a totally different dynamic because senators have a whole state to think about, and any senator with a significant rural expanse in their state has to listen to their general aviation pilots, rural airports that are concerned about losing access to commercial airlines and commercial service. And that's why the reaction in the Senate has been much more subdued and why this effort hasn't really taken off so much in that chamber.
Lauren, we're approaching a break, but I want to ask you one more question before we go to break. You know, part of the challenge for the administration is keeping the focus on their agenda, and that's not straightforward these days in Washington with the political static there, various investigations into Russian election hacking and possible involvement by Trump campaign officials. Later this week, all eyes will be on former FBI Director James Comey, who will testify before Congress. How is all this affecting the prospects for a plan like this, for this infrastructure plan?
It definitely impacts how much Democrats are willing to step up to the negotiating table with the administration. The administration had definitely thought that something like infrastructure could be a bipartisan win for them. Democrats want to spend money on infrastructure. They're interested in seeing some major changes. But ever since the public-private partnership aspect of this has been touted more and more, Democrats have been increasingly wary of getting on board. And the Russia situation is only playing into that.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the White House's rollout this week of plans to modernize the nation's connective tissue, the infrastructure we all rely on. In his victory speech on election night last November, President-elect Donald Trump again pledged to fix America's infrastructure with a $1 trillion plan. Here he is.
We are going to fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure, which will become, by the way, second to none. And we will put millions of our people to work as we rebuild it.
The Trump administration is rolling out a plan, a public-private partnership to fund this idea. You can join the conversation. How are the roads, the airports, the transit systems in your part of the country? Do you think Donald Trump, who promised to use his builder's drive and knowledge to lead the nation, can leave this country in better shape? My guest is Lauren Gardner, who covers transportation for Politico Pro. And let me bring in two more guests. First, Richard Geddes joins us from Ithaca, New York. He is professor in the Department of Policy Analysis and Management at Cornell and visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Richard Geddes, welcome to On Points. Good to have you.
Thanks, Anthony. Great to be here.
And Robert Puentes joins us from Washington. He is president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation and a visiting scholar at the Brookings Institution. Robert Puentes, thank you for joining us as well.
Well, hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
So, Richard Geddes, let me start with you. Basic definition. What do we mean by infrastructure, first of all? I mean, how do you define that term?
Well, Anthony, infrastructure refers to huge sectors of the U.S. economy. There's different ways of breaking it up. I think when you launch that word to most people, they think of civil infrastructure, such as roads, bridges, tunnels, ports, airports. Perhaps they think of the electric grid. They might also think of water infrastructure like roads, levees, dams, drinking water systems, wastewater treatment systems, seaports, all of these different physical or civil infrastructure things that are often part of a larger network, Anthony, I think are what pop into people's minds when you say that. But there's also, you know, in this world of infrastructure, other what we call social infrastructure that just provides basic public goods such as schools, prisons, courthouses, standalone facilities like that, Anthony.
Yeah.
So really, when you say infrastructure, there's this huge swath of the U.S. economy that is typically covered by that definition. So it's important to be careful about what you're referring to.
And I want to ask you both, Richard Geddes and Robert Fuentes, the same question that I asked Lauren at the end of the last break, and that is, give me a quick, give our listeners a really brief sort of analysis of your view of the challenge here that the Trump administration is talking about, and indeed Democrats and Republicans have been talking about for a long, long time in Washington, to fix the nation's infrastructure. Richard, I'll start with you. What's the challenge? How do you define it?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Anthony. And I think, you know, there's a lot in the current discussion. There's a lot to unpack. And you often hear about infrastructure gaps. And I think, you know, there's a gap in our infrastructure funding or financing. And I think it's important to unpack that and say there's two main gaps that we should think about. One is the funding gap. And that is the difference between what our civil engineers tell us we need to keep our infrastructure in a state of good repair, and that's the term you often hear, versus what we have available coming in from all our different sources of revenue. And those sources of revenue for, say, roads could be tolls, they could be gas taxes, they could be truck tire taxes, gas and diesel taxes at both the state and the federal level, or now increasingly in some states, mileage-based user fees. Those are all, you know, on the revenue side. The difference between those two things, the money you have coming in versus the money you need to keep it in at least in a state of good repair, is the funding gap. And that's versus a financing gap. And the financing gap refers to once you have the funding in place, those basic sources of revenue going to the capital markets, going to the tax-exempt municipal bond markets, the taxable corporate bond markets, or also increasingly to public-private partnership where there's actually equity in a contract to provide some infrastructure. What will the financial markets give you? So I think the U.S. has problems in both of those areas. I think the more fundamental gap in some sense is the funding gap. Lauren referred to that in the last segment in terms of more tolling and mileage-based user fees, the underlying dollars. But I think an even related to that, Anthony, perhaps an even deepened problem that the U.S. has is, look, we have a mature system. We've been lucky for the past decades. We have basic infrastructure. We've had it for a long time that provides us with excellent public services like mobility through the interstate highway system, or clean water through our drinking system and wastewater treatment systems, or power through the electric grid, or freight transportation with our ports, airports, et cetera. The problem, Anthony, that the United States faces is that a lot of this is old. It needs to be renovated, and it has not been properly maintained for a long time. So I think rather than building out a new giant system like the interstate highways that we did in the 50s and 60s, now we have the problem of addressing the deferred maintenance problem.
Deferred maintenance.
So I think that those are the main issues.
Yeah, big issues. Robert Fuentes, same question to you. I mean, how serious is the problem? Crumbling bridges and roads, the need to update airports and aging rail lines and everything else.
Yeah, you know, I think all that is true. In fact, the problem we've had in this country is that we've taken really a crisis-driven approach to infrastructure. Every time a bridge collapses or an Amtrak train crashes or a water main fails or the grid goes down, we have a big flurry of activity around infrastructure. We talk about it a lot, and then little to nothing seems to get done. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. We do take this too abstract approach to infrastructure. So I was very glad you asked the question, what do we mean by that? Because it really matters, because each of these sectors that you've already ticked through today, transportation, energy, water, telecommunications, all of these sectors are designed and governed and financed and delivered very, very differently. And the federal role in those depends on and they have a different role in the different sectors. But we tend to overemphasize the federal role. The president had talked about it yesterday. There has been a ton of activity about it in the last couple of days because the president talked about infrastructure. But the fact of the matter is the states, the localities do so much on infrastructure. They're out there raising their own revenues, engaging in new kinds of partnerships and new kinds of programs. So the federal government needs to be present, but it's not the only thing. The federal government isn't going to solve all of these challenges because, as Rick was saying, it's really about funding and finance and how you get stuff done now.
And I want to get into that sort of funding and finance and how we get stuff done and how the Trump administration's approach would do that. But we've got a lot of listeners who already want to get in on this conversation, so I want to get at least a few callers in now with some questions. Let's go to Leo, who's calling from Akron, Ohio. Leo, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. How many years did President Obama talk about a public-private infrastructure bank getting absolutely no interest from congressional Republicans because they didn't want to spend the money, and this despite record low interest rates, and now suddenly they're on board with this? I mean, give me a break.
So is that the question, Leo? I mean, are you asking, are Republicans serious about this? Robert Puentes, go ahead, Robert Puentes. Respond to Leo's question.
This is the idea of the infrastructure bank has been one for not just the last administration, but for administrations before. The challenge we have in Washington is these big ideas get associated with one party or the other, and then politics seeps in. So this whole idea that President Trump talked about yesterday about spinning off air traffic control to a nonprofit entity wasn't something they came up with over the last couple of months. I'm glad they endorsed it, but this is something that goes all the way back, as Lauren said, to the Clinton administration. So we've got to stop lurching from administration to administration, saddling these ideas with different individuals, because then politics seeps in and breaks the whole thing down. We've got to think about it as a long-term impact for the country.
Interesting. Richard Geddes, I want to ask you about this because, you know, the point here is that it seems like in the political world, right, liberals hate the idea of privatization and often characterize it as a way to socialize the cost and privatize the profit. Conservatives, on the other hand, have a problem with massive public spending programs because they're seen as inefficient and wasteful. But it sounds like, you know, when we talk to the experts like you and Robert Puentes, that you don't freight these conversations with the same political baggage, I guess.
Well, Anthony, I think we should all try to avoid that as much as we can, because I think we have common interests in, you know, the basic public services that are provided by the infrastructure that we're talking about. And actually, I think what you said is very true, Anthony. When you get into the policy details of how we actually have to address both the funding and financing and the operation and maintenance problems that we face today, I think there's actually more bipartisan agreement on what are wise solutions and what are not wise solutions. So one thing I would say with regard to Leo's question, you know, we to some extent we already have an infrastructure bank within USDOT that's called TIFIA, which stands for the Transportation Infrastructure Financing and Innovation Act Credit Facility, which the memo put out by the administration would expand TIFIA's credit. You know, it's for projects of national and regional significance. So if a state wants to do a major project that meets that definition, but it doesn't have the financing quite in place, maybe it's missing 30% of the financing, TIFIA would step in with low-cost loans to help them complete that. In my state of New York, the Tappan Zee Bridge replacement project got the largest TIFIA loan in history. So that's a great example of how TIFIA was used to support a major infrastructure project that the entire region will benefit from. So we could expand TIFIA, build upon it, and we're sort of almost to an infrastructure bank already. I think, you know, I think that's a good thing. And the other thing, Anthony, is just, you know, in the proposal is more user fees. So we have to pay for this stuff. It's not free. It's extremely expensive. Where's the money going to come from? As an economist, of course, I'm going to say that it's better to charge users per unit of use, like per lane mile used, than it is to use broad general tax revenues to fund these things. Mm. And there's some administrative proposals to liberalize tolling on the interstates, to allow states to experiment with more congestion pricing that would facilitate that.
So I have a question. I just want to
that would be bipartisan.
Yeah, excuse me for jumping in there, because my question I want to ask, I'm going to ask all three of you this question, but just stick with me, Richard Geddes. If we're talking about focusing on user fees and public-private partnerships, aren't we talking about specific kinds of infrastructure that would lend themselves to that kind of funding mechanism? In other words, Robert Puentes sort of gave a list a moment ago of, you know, transportation, water, telecommunications, roads and bridges. Are all of these sort of infrastructure needs going to respond well to this kind of funding approach that the Trump administration is proposing?
Well, so again, we need to be careful, Anthony, about making that division between funding and financing. Mm-hmm. And I just do want to take a step back because the term public-private partnership is used so often and is thrown about. And I think it's useful for listeners to, you know, take a step back and say, what do we mean by that? Well, public-private partnership is really just a large contract, a major contract between a public sector project sponsor. That is the government entity. It could be a state, could be a municipality, could be the federal government, and a private entity that is going to provide some service to the government. That service could be a bunch of things bundled together for infrastructure, like the design, the construction, the operation, maintenance, and even the financing of a facility for a long period of time, like 25 or 30 years. So the PPP is not going to provide you, you know, with a revenue source. But I think what it will do is give you that life cycle maintenance of the asset. I do believe per dollar of revenue, say toll revenue on a road, bridge, or tunnel that you have, it'll give you more upfront financing. And I do believe it brings in more global expertise into all of this stuff.
Interesting.
And these are often global companies that do this. So I think that the PPP can do some things. It is very facility dependent. You're right on that, Anthony. But I think the United States is behind the curve in using this.
Interesting. Robert Puentes, your view on sort of, you know, being how facility dependent is the public-private partnership model being talked about in Washington right now?
It's what it's all about. The private sector is not going to be interested in areas of infrastructure where they can't generate a profit. That's not a tremendous insight from me. I mean, that's what they're trying to make some kind of profit for their shareholders or for themselves. Nothing wrong with that, but that's the way we got to think about it. They're not going to come in and solve all of our needs across all areas of infrastructure. We have massive problems with our public transit systems in places like Boston, New York, Washington, D.C. I don't see a whole lot of private sector interest in investing infrastructure or investing dollars to get those systems up to a state of good repair. And when it comes to things like the nation's air traffic control system that the president talked about yesterday, it is technically privatization, but it's really non-profitization because they're spinning it off to a separate entity that's, by definition, not going to generate a profit. There are no shareholders. They're not trying to be profit-making. And so the term privatization matters. We should be talking about it. But it's so diverse. It's so facility-driven. It's so sector-driven that we've got to be specific because it's not going to solve all of our problems. It's not going to be used in all circumstances.
Let's go to Randy, who's calling from Corydon, Indiana. Randy, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. Part of my question on this is if you privatize, for example, air traffic control systems, what's to stop these private companies from selling their share to a foreign government?
That's a good question, Randy. Randy, let me put that to Robert Puentes because he was just sort of talking about this issue a moment ago before you called. Robert, take on Randy's question there.
Just very quickly, this is not about a profit-making company. With shareholders, this is about a nonprofit entity, similar to how they do it in Canada and some other places, that would be made up of a range of different stakeholders. It would include the airlines. It would include other experts and other stakeholder interests. They wouldn't have the ability to sell shares because there wouldn't be any shares. It would be a system kind of similar to the U.S. Olympic Committee or the Red Cross. It's this quasi-public kind of private entity, but focused on, again, nonprofit is the important word here. This is not an organization that's going to be trying to maximize returns for any investors. It's really about the safe and efficient use of the nation's air traffic system.
All right, listeners, we're talking about the plan to upgrade and improve, repair the nation's infrastructure system. What do you think about the Trump administration's approach? Do you think it can take off, that it can find political support in Washington? Robert Puentes, president and CEO of ENO, Center for Transportation, and a visiting scholar at the Brookings Institution. Robert, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
It's fun. Thanks for having me.
And Richard Geddes, he's professor in the Department of Policy Analysis and Management at Cornell and a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Richard Geddes, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks, Anthony.
And Lauren Gardner, she covers transportation for Politico Pro. She's going to stick with us for the next segment. We're going to be talking about the politics of all this. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first 3 meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Infrastructure Week at the White House, this week's rollout of the administration's $1 trillion plan to modernize the nation's roads, bridges, airports, and more. You can join the conversation. Is this something both political parties can get behind on? Do you think the White House has the right ideas? Lauren Gardner is with me. She covers transportation for Politico Pro. And Lauren, let's get a couple of calls in here. Linda is calling from Somerset, Kentucky. Linda, you're on the air.
Well, thank you, Anthony. I am calling because I feel the first item on any infrastructure agenda should be the water systems in this country. NPR reported recently that over 3,000 municipalities have lead levels in their drinking water worse than Flint, Michigan. This is a national crisis, it seems to me. It means millions of people are being poisoned and millions of children will not reach the potential they have. It's a massive jobs program, and how do we pay for it? Well, I'm not totally clear on that, but I do think we should get a look at the secret budget that the U.S. has for Homeland Security, CIA, so on.
All right, Linda, before we get too deep into secret budgets, I think the idea of addressing water is a great question. Let me put it on the table to Lauren Gardner. Lauren, is there talk of addressing the nation's water systems that Linda was bringing up?
The definition of infrastructure is certainly up for debate right now within the administration and on Capitol Hill. How broad is this effort going to be? I believe drinking water has been talked about. Including veterans hospitals has been talked about on the administration side. The nation's energy grid is also something that lawmakers are looking into to see how they could possibly incorporate an effort to modernize and update that into any kind of legislative package they consider. So lots of different elements of quote-unquote infrastructure are on the table. It just remains to be seen what, at the end of the day, will make it into anything that Congress considers.
Really interesting. I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. Margaret Talov is senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg, and I want to spend a little time talking about the sort of political reality in Washington and the political climate for addressing this. And Margaret joins us from Washington. Margaret, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hi, Anthony. It's great to be here. And hi, Lauren.
Hi, Margaret.
So, Margaret, we talked a little bit about this in the first segment with Lauren, and that is the current political climate in Washington in terms of how possible it is to push something like this through. You know, I'm sitting in a studio, and in front of me is CNN, and I'm reading the chyrons. I'm not hearing what they're saying because I'm live on the radio, but all of the focus right now is on Trump's tweets, his argument with the mayor of London, the fact that Comey is going to be testifying in Washington, former FBI director Comey is going to be testifying in Washington on Thursday, and on and on and on. Nobody, it seems, is talking about infrastructure. How important is that in terms of the overall climate to try to get something like this done in Washington?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head. This was something that President Obama struggled with. And now, even though the kind of split between the White House and Congress isn't there anymore, Obama saw infrastructure, and so did Paul Ryan, as one of those things that could bridge the gap. Now you have a Republican president, two Republican-controlled chambers of commerce. But as much as the filibuster rule has been diminished, this is something where you probably still need 60 votes for the most part to do something like this. And you have Democrats who are really, really lined up. It would be very difficult to get Democrats to compromise on anything to help this president, but infrastructure could be one of those things, particularly for Democrats who face close contests in 2018, who really need infrastructure improvements for their districts or their states. That's out there, right? That's a possibility. The problem, again, has been this political climate, and a lot of this has been driven by the president himself. So you see Republican consultants saying that the constant tweets make it very difficult to do deal making on something like this. You see in the context of this week that even though infrastructure is just as a matter of course something that is important to this president, important to the idea that they have elected a real estate developer, a builder, he's someone who understands and cares about these things. But it is all, the story is being told in the context of, oh, the infrastructure push can be a distraction against the Jim Comey hearings. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to distinguish between a privatization effort like what the air traffic control plan is versus this larger sort of notion of leveraging what the president's vision, $200 billion in order to get about $1 trillion out of states and cities and private investors. There is a discrepancy. He's aiming for $1 trillion. There are a lot of experts who say it really needs to be double that. But you see there the potential for this sort of compromise when you have CEOs like Lloyd Blankfein, like Jamie Dimon, saying, hey, we all need to rally together around that. That is potentially how a compromise like this can come together. The question is, will President Trump step on his own ability to make that happen?
Well, interesting. Just to get a taste of some of the politics around this, let's listen to a little tape. Here's Donald Trump as he unfurled his plan for the nation's air traffic control system yesterday. The president criticized the Obama administration's effort to upgrade the aging national system. Here he is.
The previous administration spent over $7 billion trying to upgrade the system and totally failed. Honestly, they didn't know what the hell they were doing. A total waste of money. $7 billion plus. It's time to join the future.
So there's President Trump speaking yesterday. But here, when the White House presented its budget 2 weeks ago, Senator Chuck Schumer went to the Senate floor to slam it. He said the White House's budget actually slashes spending on infrastructure. Here's Senator Schumer.
The president promised to increase infrastructure investment, but his budget actually cuts more money from infrastructure programs than the new money it puts in. The president's proposal to slash American infrastructure investments is a job-killing 180-degree turn away from his repeated promise of a trillion-dollar infrastructure plan. President Trump's campaign promises on infrastructure are crumbling faster than our roads and bridges.
So, Margaret Talofkin, are Democrats still going to be talking like that after this week about this plan?
Well, when the president's opening salvo to the Democrats is to bash everything the previous administration did. I mean, there's like, you know, I worked in Florida for a while, and when you work in the South, there's an expression about a spoonful of sugar, right? President Trump does not embrace the spoonful of sugar.
You mean
approach.
He could have found a more delicate way to say Obama might have done more other than he was a total failure?
I'd like to build on some of the work of the Obama administration,
gotcha,
reaching out to Democrats to see what we can get done together. If you don't, and I'm not saying he should choose that approach, I'm just saying, when you don't choose that approach, it makes the Democratic reaction all the more predictable. And of course, a lot of this is not about President Trump. It comes back down to the old idea about, do you do infrastructure by raising taxes, or do you try to find some way to minimize the burden to the federal taxpayer by creating, quote, public-private partnerships, which you can do in many states, but not all states. So maybe two-thirds of the states, three-fourths of the states this is possible in, but it would box some states out. Do you do it by passing along user fees? Is that an acceptable form of a tax increase? How do you pay for it? It has always been one of the central questions, and it's much harder to get to the answer to that question when there's political firebombs being thrown in both directions.
And Lauren Gardner, I mean, it's interesting, you know, when we were talking earlier in the hour about the plan to privatize the air traffic control system, I mean, the Trump administration, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the reading that I was doing this morning, looked at that proposal as sort of low-hanging fruit because it's something that's been around for a while that Democrats and Republicans have both been talking about. But in this climate, may be difficult to push even something like that through.
That's right. This proposal is essentially half to three quarters of the way cooked, right? It's been around for a while. Chairman Schuster has been working on it for several years. It's not a new idea, and administration officials admitted as much. And also, we're talking about how, you know, in terms of prospects for getting this done, they're saying, well, you know, this is the first time we've had a Republican White House, Republican-controlled House and Senate. So, you know, our hope is that all of us having control of all those levers of government is going to make this easier. But this isn't a Republican-Democrat firmly partisan issue. This is rural interests not being totally on board. This is members of Congress listening to other stakeholders out there that, you know, that aren't divided on party lines having issues with this. So it's not going to be as black and white as Republican versus Democrat here.
All right, let's go to the calls. Tori is calling from Rapid City, South Dakota. Hi, Tori, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony, how we doing?
Very well. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'd say I just, you know, I want to know with the whole infrastructure plan is that will our Congress finally start working together? That's the biggest thing, you know, with the president. It's going to have to come down to, you know, the problem with our infrastructure, you know, is that it's going to take many, many years of presidents to be willing to work with each other. So, you know, my wonder is that, you know, maybe if President Trump would be willing to work towards, you know, like, how instead of fighting all of Obama, what President Obama had set forth, maybe if he'd be willing to stick with some of President Obama, just some way to get Democrats and Republicans to finally set aside their differences and start working together and say, yeah, let's go ahead and give this a shot.
Tori, it's a great point, and we've talked a little bit about it, and I'm going to come back to this point. So I'm grateful that you put it on the table for us. Again, we're going to go back into that a little bit deeply in a moment. I want to get a couple of other thoughts on the table here. So let's go to Tom, who's calling from Columbia, Missouri. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. Anthony, I like the talk of the infrastructure bank. That's good to hear. But I like the public-private idea being more concentrated on. And the idea, it would bring a better balance to our infrastructure system. Look, government has assumed an inordinate percentage of infrastructural spending and maintenance, and our system is sagging under that plan. Let me give you a specific example. I live in Missouri. In Missouri, we have I-70 cutting right through the state. Now, MoDOT wants to widen I-70 from 4 lanes to 8 because there's so much long-haul truck traffic passing through Missouri. Okay, there's short-haul, medium-haul, and long-haul. But just south of I-70 is a railroad, a super high-capacity road right there. It can carry far more weight than the freeway. Every railroad car carries as much weight as three of those giant semis on the highway. And because of government subsidies, the government subsidies for the federal highway system has now moved the freight from the rails, long-haul freight, not just short and medium, but long-haul freight from the rails to the highways.
Tom, I get it. I mean, it's a great point you put on the table. Let me go to Lauren Gardner about this, because Lauren, of course, a long history in America of favoring roads over railways in many ways. Speak to what Tom is talking about. What do you hear in that call?
Yeah, there's between freight carriers on the rails and long-haul truckers, there's always that kind of push and pull between, you know, the roads get some federal funding, whereas when it comes to freight railroads, that's all private sector funding. They finance that on their own. And that's why when you hear all this talk about how do you pay for the nation's infrastructure, freight railroads are very clear that they think it should be, you know, a user fee type system, that's how that's all taken care of. So there's always some tension there between those two different modes. But at the end of the day, generally you hear everyone talking about how we all need to work together. Interstate commerce happens through all different types of modes of transportation. So at the end of the day, everything has to work together because it's all interconnected.
Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Omaha. Jim, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Do you think there's enough American labor available that will be willing to do all of this infrastructure work? Thanks.
All right. Well, good question. Lauren, I think that again, a question for you. Enough labor to do this work, enough people willing to do it?
That's a great question. You hear a lot of talk from members of Congress that, you know, there are construction workers, you know, waiting to have a steady stream of funding so that they know the project that they were planning to work on will actually go through, so they can get building during building season, which we're in right now. It starts in the springtime. So you always hear about the jobs that infrastructure building can create. So people in Washington definitely seem to think that there are hands out there ready to get out there and and get these projects going.
Yeah, and Margaret, I want to come back to you. You know, we heard two callers ago talking about just sort of this yearning for Democrats and Republicans to finally work together, and maybe this is something that can happen. You've suggested that that may not, in fact, happen in the current climate in Washington. But looking forward, I mean, is it something that could change? What's your view?
I think from a political standpoint, you look at infrastructure as part of this sort of broader canvas of all the issues that this administration and the Republican-led Congress wanted to tackle, an overhaul of tax policy, infrastructure, health care. Among all those, infrastructure, in a sense, was supposed to be the easy one, even though, as we've been talking about in this discussion, there's a lot of things about it that are complicated. But this is an area where you have CEOs from across the partisan spectrum and in a nonpartisan context talking about the importance of this for the economy, for job creation. Obviously, it's a national security issue. It's just a quality of life issue. There is a lot of room potentially for political compromise. The challenge again and again has been the political climate, and the president is at the top of the food chain in terms of setting the political tone. You see how much difficulty there has been moving the agenda already on health care and on taxes. This infrastructure remains potentially the easiest area for bipartisan compromise. I look at it as kind of a weather vane for how possible other legislative movement is if they're not able to move the ball on this. And if they are, it creates, however small a window between now and the midterms to try to get something accomplished.
All right. Well, we'll be watching that. All about setting the political tone in Washington. And so far, that political tone has been pretty sour. Margaret Taleff, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg, thank you so much for joining us this hour. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And Lauren Gardner, she covers transportation for Political Pro. Lauren, thank you for your help.
Thanks, Anthony.
That's it for this hour. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.